Hello, everyone. Welcome to Tech Can Save Us podcast, brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I'm one of your co-hosts, Paul David, CEO and co-founder of Literal Humans. I'll let my colleague Will introduce himself.
Hey, team. Will Gazvi-Pete here, the other co-founder of Literal Humans. Very excited for another great pod.
And we're very excited today to have Anna Moreno, the founder of Altruistic Capital. They do what they, you know, how they're named exactly there. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Paul and William, to receive me in your podcast. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm excited about this conversation.
Us too, 100%.
Well, obviously, the name of your company jumped out, and we'll talk about that in a minute and dig into exactly what it is that Altruistic Capital does. I know our audience of angel investors and VCs, startup founders will be very keen to hear what you have to say about all things investment in an altruistic way. But first, we're going to jump into some headlines. So before the podcast, we shared a couple articles with you, and we just wanted to talk through a couple headlines. The first about social justice, and this piece talked about, you know, human instincts from the American scientist and just kind of like, you know, what's in our nature. And just be curious, as someone who's named their company Altruistic, which is very much about, you know, sort of justice and doing the right thing, what, you know, what's your sort of take on social justice? And you know, it's very in vogue right now. So do you think it's kind of, you think it comes naturally to us? Or do you think, you know, it's something that needs to be fostered and taught and practiced?
I think it's something natural for humans. I think humans naturally can understand what is fair and what's unfair, because we can compare our situation with the situation of others and see if we are in a better condition in comparison of other people. And it's interesting for parents, for example, if, I don't know if you have a child or not, but I have one. And for him, it's so easy to see when something is not fair enough, when it's not just enough. And he all the time is keeps saying to me, "Mom, that's not fair enough. It's not fair enough to have, for example, homeless people." And so I think social justice is something that we are all born with the capacity to understand what is it and to recognize a situation that's not fair.
Yeah, one of the kind of core questions of that piece is like, how has it taken so long for these themes of social justice to come back into the mainstream? You know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to look at the state of the world today and realize that, you know, a lot of things are truly unfair. And I'd be interested to know, you know, for you, how has this happened? How have we got to a place where, you know, for 20 years, people have been writing about inequality and longer still? Why is it that it seems to only just now be people going, okay, well, actually, how do we fix this? And social justice is sort of creeping back into the mainstream of journalistic discourse and scientific discourse.
Yes, this question is very tricky, because I believe that there is a natural process of development of the humanity. So I really believe that I can see that during the centuries, humanity is getting better in the process of improving human rights, for example, in understanding what is just and what is not just, and being more able to put in place mechanisms that enable social justice to be implemented. And we see a lot of regulations around this matter, so an improvement around this matter in terms of the regulations. But what is tricky is that when we look at the numbers are not aligned with the regulations. So there is a discompass in terms of what we have in terms of the mindset. So I think the humanity understands what we need to do in terms of social justice, but we still face a big challenge in putting in place mechanisms that are able to face all this injustice that we have. At the same time, I believe that we have a natural process of development. So step by step, I think humanity is getting better in doing social justice. But we really need, I think as humans, we need convenient processes to put in place things that are cool, are good for the environment and for society in general. So if something is not convenient, it's hard for us to do. And it's not because we don't want to do something, but it's just because it's not convenient enough. So, for example, many people know that sponges that we use in our kitchen. It's not good for the environment. Most of them are not good for the environment. But at least in Brazil, what we would need to do in order to not harm the environment is to go to the post office and send all the sponges to the company. And this is not convenient at all. So even though most people that are aware of this problem would want to do this, because it's not convenient, they still remain throwing out sponges on the normal garbage, and that's not good for the environment. So I think the same thinking and the same mechanism we can put in place to all things related to social justice. So if we don't have convenient mechanisms for everybody to work on doing more for the environment, more for the society, we are not going to face social injustice.
Yeah, my answer to the question about why it's taken so long, and this comes from a career working in, part of a career working in education and nonprofits and charities in the States, at least, is like, I think, and a bit of a hot take, and I'm curious to hear, Anna, your reaction to this. I think we've institutionalized inequality, and we've created like a structure, and a lot of people argue, obviously, that it's, you know, inequality is inherent to capitalist economics and stuff like that. I would probably tend to agree, but we've created these things that we, I think, conceptually think are substitutes for justice, be it economic justice, social justice, environmental justice, charity. Just the concept that, like, we have charities, like, you know, organizations who do things for people that society and government haven't figured out how to do, provide them with housing, provide them with food, basic necessities. Like, the fact that we've institutionalized charities is mind-blowing to me. And connected to that, I think philanthropy is connected to that. Philanthropy, charity, and I would even argue, like, even the most earnest venture capitalists trying to solve, you know, these big issues are no substitute for the condition of justice. You know, like, people being able to go out in the world and to, like, make a living, to have housing, to have, you know, a full education, and not have to go to a venture capitalist or a charity or, you know, a church or any other place to get a handout to get those basic things. And I think we go to these galas and we sort of, like, pat ourselves on the back and feel really good about giving, but without asking, like, why are we in a state where we have to give in that particular way? Now, that doesn't mean we should stop, right? That, like, charity should stop, or VC should stop, or philanthropy should stop. It just means that I think we should, like, question some of the underlying structures and, like, beliefs that, like, that say, oh, this is fine, but, like, not that don't push us towards justice. And the last thing I'll say on this is, you know, I think there's been some fascinating research done in the States about how we've turned people into more of consumers and less of citizens, right? So, like, now people are like, oh, I'll go start a nonprofit. I'll go, you know, start a company or something like that. I'll go donate. But people aren't out in the streets. I mean, 2020, I think, was the sort of anomaly to that. But we've, I think, ceded a lot of our citizenship and a lot of our agency as democratic citizens to advocate for things, to advocate for government to do things differently. And we turned it into, you know, either consumerism or capitalism or some form of, like, us being economic actors. And I think that has, again, institutionalized things like charities and philanthropy and VCs. So, like, that's my sort of hot take on, like, why I think it's taken so long, is if you just created a structure that's just like, yeah, this is how we live. There's homeless people and there's homeless charities that take care of that, instead of, this is an outrage, why hasn't the government provided enough affordable housing, you know?
My significantly less informed opinion than Anna's is kind of to agree. I think one of the great successes of sort of Thatcher and Reagan economics is to take that community mindset and just flip it on its head and go, you know, people that are homeless, it's their fault. They failed at capitalism. They failed at the game that we all play, and they should be shunned and looked down upon rather than looked after. And, you know, 20 years ago, you know, don't get me wrong, I don't want to idealize the sort of 50s or the 60s. They were incredibly racist and sexist times, and we have objectively progressed as a society since then. But one thing they did have that I don't think we have anymore, and I think needs to be married with all of this, is a genuine sense of community in local towns. And, you know, when you had an aging parent that was, you know, maybe a little bit doddery and not all there anymore, it wasn't just you and your family's problem. The village would come together and and you would look after that person just for no, you know, no financial gain, no benefit to you other than it is the right thing to do, and that's what communities do. And I think we've lost that. And if we could make, you know, to your point, Anna, about the rules and regulations of society have progressed and the world is objectively a better place than it was in the 50s and 60s, but if we could combine that progress in terms of social values and rules with the sense of community, I think that's when suddenly society can really fulfill the kind of potential that, you know, humanity has for good, as well as we've seen, lots and lots of bad.
Yeah, want to push us to the next question here, which I think connects really nicely to your point, Will, of like, you know, the second piece is about funding locally. So Anna, it would be super curious to hear your perspective. Like, to me, you know, one of these elements of like getting around what we just talked about is like, look around your local community, do things locally, fund locally, you know, solve problems that are like maybe a bit more tangible for people. So it would be really curious, Anna, to hear about any efforts that you've seen around local funding, or just your broad perspective about, you know, funding hyper locally in the space that you're in.
It's so interesting that you recognize the same as me, Paul. You have the same vision as me. And it's not something common, because I worked for the government. So working for the government gives you a little bit of a sense about the responsibility of the government and this whole mess that we are. And I'm also a social worker. So all of this that we are talking about is social policy, theories of social policy. And why it's taking so long for us to face social justice is, I agree with you that this is super related with the capitalism. That is the economic model that we are right now. So actually we need to face inequality and we need to do more. We already have a very disproportional distribution in terms of the income. So we are not doing enough in terms of the policies, the public policies. Because you touched on this point, I can't not talk about the basic income policy. And for many people, this would be could have a great role in facing social injustice. Because then people would have the basic needs, and that's what we can't live with. And you touched on this point, in the point that right now it's natural for us to have people living in an unjust situation. And if we had, for example, a basic income, we could face this, or at least a part of the problem. Not all the problem, but a part of the problem. And just to comment what William said about the communities, I think that's super important. As a social worker, I believe that there is not other way to have strong people in terms of their mental health, in terms of their economic and many other things related to the well-being if the community is not strong enough. And when we think about poor communities, for example, they have a great level of collaboration, and because they need this, and if they don't collaborate, their lives would be worse. And when we look for communities that are not poor, they lack this collaboration, and their lives is not good enough in other terms. So having access to services because you have money is not enough for humans to be happy, to have an entire life, plenitude in their life. So this is super important. So now the other question that is about
funding locally. So like grounding in the needs of like the local community and community-based organizations, you know, yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
Yes, this is a part of our main values in altruistic capital, because the greatest way to incentivize economic development is maintaining the money in the communities. So buying from locals, investing in locals, it's not possible to do things differently if we want, for example, to face inequality in terms of income. Because when we support local businesses, we are supporting the ones that are the smallest ones and the medium ones. So I have a belief that is, corporations are not good for the world. So I always think that it's a kind of tricky, my job, because I want to support businesses to grow. But if they turn into corporations, this is not going to be good for the world. So I'm always thinking about which kind of business that would be the most interesting to support. And when I think of this, I think on cooperatives, for example, on organizations that have a governance model that's more democratic and that are able to share all the income that they are able to make. So when we think about this kind of organization, it's great to think about organizations that are going to grow. So as clients, as customers, I think we should try, and investors also, we should think about trying to support organizations, businesses that are aligned with our values, but start with the smallest ones and the medium ones and the local ones. Because then it's not a guarantee, but for sure you can guarantee that you are generating jobs, local jobs, which is great. You are maintaining the income in the area, in your sector, for example, where do you live. And this is great for the local economy. But what I think is interesting to think is that nowadays, the concept of community is totally different from what we had in the past. Because a community right now is not necessarily your local community where you live. So right now, I tend to think that your local community maybe is not the one that is near you, but the community that has the same mindset as you. So in my situation, for example, I'm from Brazil. I live in Brazil and my business is worldwide, but I'm focusing to start in the UK. And I have friends in all over the world and we have similar thinking. So I think we are a community. So in Altruistic Capital, we try to incentivize people to invest in people that is part of your community, even though these people is not people that is living near you, because you could, for example, invest in a business that is local, but it is from another country, for example.
Yeah, I think that point about there's sort of, yeah, two strands there. Your kind of local community in terms of the people that share your beliefs, and then also at the genuinely local level geographically. I think one of the things is just, you know, focus small but dream big. There really is a surprising amount of stuff you can do as a local community that I think we're almost tried to train out of in terms of kind of the nihilism of our time of like, oh, you can't make a difference, why bother, don't try. And the truth is you can. And, you know, something as simple as setting up a food drive in your local area, you know, creating a local network of WhatsApp of local parents where you share clothes and toys from all of your, you know, the kids that you're all having, like those little things, like they might only make a big impact to a few hundred people, but they really can change people's lives. And my brother recently was having a chat with someone at his local nursery and they mentioned that a local pub was going to be up for sale. And it turned out that the building was a building of community interest, which meant that they could apply to take over the building and run it by the community. You know, it's a really ridiculous long legal process. You basically have to just luck out a bit with the leaseholder. And it worked. And in a month's time, my brother and all of the local community are going to launch a pub that doesn't need to make a profit, and instead all of the money goes into community projects, including, you know, a kitchen where anyone can show up and have a free meal two or three times a week. You know, all of that from a conversation of just actually being active and local in your community and believing you can make a difference and having, you know, the audacity to just try and roll the dice. So yeah, I do think there's just a lot we can do. And, you know, don't believe people that tell you, you know, you can't make a difference and it's not going to happen. Just give it a go. And you never know, like, it's amazing how much impact you can have locally.
Yeah, I think the pandemic definitely, it turned me more local. Like, I started like looking at local, you know, food kitchens and places to donate clothes and things like that. And it just, I saw a lot of this too in the States of like mutual aid societies, for example, people bringing together money. And like, we got to get, you know, to the point that you said, well, like, we got to get, you know, Grandma Pookie her toilet paper, you know, like stuff like that. It just feels so And I think that's a real missed opportunity for a lot of progressive, dare I say, you know, leftist liberal groups to like latch on to that, and not in like a co-opting way to like, you know, co-opt it politically, but to just say like, look, we do things differently, we believe differently. Like there's no reason that like the Democratic Party in the US and the Labour Party, you know, in the UK shouldn't be getting involved with that and saying like, we actually help, you know, feed the community, and we you know, support organizations and back them and things like that. I just think it's a real missed opportunity by a lot of folks on the left to like institutionalize the opposite of what we see, you know, to institutionalize like taking care of that elderly person in your neighborhood and connecting it to like our political and institutional values. So maybe it's better they stay out of it because they screw everything up, but we'll see. This is directly relevant to the next piece actually, and it, you know, discusses kind of social value being at the top of the agenda. So it's, you know, for over the past few years, it's very much in vogue right now. You see the rise of ESGs and you know, funders looking at ESG metrics and things like that. Different corporations are institutionalizing social impact into, you know, how they measure the work they're doing. It's also connected to the funding environment. You see people starting to move beyond tracking social impact as like a box ticking exercise. So Anna, I would just be curious to hear, you know, you obviously started a company called Altruistic Capital in the midst of all that. What's your perspective on social value kind of rising up the chain in terms of, you know, how companies are working?
What intrigued me the most when working in the government was the effectiveness of the programs. And I think the matter of social value is exactly related with this kind of issue. That is, what kind of social value that charities or even companies in general are delivering for the environment, for society. And everybody's trying to understand this now. It's nice to see that there is a movement around trying to understand what's social value. And for me, it's super interesting because I'm a researcher also, because I did 2 masters. So I'm always thinking how to analyze the effectiveness of a program, how to make this thing something very easy for anybody to understand. Because as I told you, doing things in a way that's convenient, it's very important. So everybody wants to know what's the social value, for example, of a charity or of a company, but they want to do this in an easy way. And there are lots of methodologies rising right now, and some are actually being more recognized as good ones. And for example, we have the Social Value International, that is one organization that's super recognized, that's doing a great job on trying to do a mechanism to measure impact that is good enough and easy enough for everybody to choose. So this is a great moment, I think. And part of my idea is trying to make this easy for investors. And I think customers in general want to do this, investors and customers in general. So everybody, I think, for people that are more concerned about the environment and the society, they would love to know in a very easy way which are the companies that are doing well, are delivering social value in an easy way and in a transparent way. And also something interesting about the moment that we are living is that many regulations are rising right now. In Europe, for example, it's huge, the number of regulations asking for companies to be more transparent about their social value. Actually, there is one particular regulation that's very interesting that is around social procurement. So right now the government needs to buy 10% of all purchases should come from companies that are able to show their social value. So they have to change the way that they are doing. They are trading, they have to look for their supply chain and try to connect with, for example, charities or social businesses or any kind of business that are able to prove that they have a social value. If they are not able to do it by themselves, they are doing this by doing some partnership with other organizations. So it's a great time in terms of the rise of social value and the awareness of it.
Thank you. Well, we're going to jump into the sort of slate of questions we have for you, dig into the work that you're doing and just a bit more about your background. So, I mean, first things first, we've mentioned Altruistic Capital. It's a fantastic name, by the way, a couple times, and would love to just hear what was your process and inspiration behind creating it? And, you know, what would you say is like your ultimate goal? Like, what do you see as success in the next few years? 3 years from now, say, Altruistic Capital, how will you know you've been successful?
The inspiration came from Yunus, Muhammad Yunus. And I saw a video from him explaining his concept about what it is a social business. That basically it is a business that has as its primary purpose to solve a social or environmental problem, but at the same time being financially sustainable. But not only these two aspects, but he also adds another layer that's very interesting, in my opinion, and it was what changed my mind and made me excited about all of this sector related to social business. That is reinvesting the profit in the mission, in the final mission of the social business. So this is a perversion of the capitalism. Not giving the profit for a shareholder and using this profit to a social or environmental mission is something that completely changed my mind. And when I heard about this concept, I thought, wow, I don't know if there is any business interested in doing this kind of crazy thing out there, but if it is, I want to support them somehow. And if there is any customer that is willing to buy only from this kind of business, I want to support them. And if there is any kind of investor that is willing to support this kind of business, I want to be the one that is going to make all things easier. So yes, this video changed my life. And after hearing Muhammad Yunus defending his concept and proving that this is possible because he did some projects around this concept, I thought I would like to support this kind of business. And I did some research, and actually I discovered that this type of business that is in the early stage process, they lack capital. Because even with all of this movement around impact investing and social businesses, investors are still afraid of investing in social businesses. And they are still looking for unicorns, for high-tech company that are going to turn into a very rich scheme and that are going to turn them millionaires. And actually, that's not the truth for the majority of businesses. The majority of businesses, even if they are not social businesses, are small businesses, are medium businesses. And those kind of businesses are the most important ones for the economy because they are the ones that generate the biggest number of jobs in the world. So they need a lot of capital. So actually, our goal is to fill this gap of raising money for early stage social businesses that are the ones that are the most impactful ones. So I want to find those businesses and support them. And actually, I also want to make the process of investment easier for the ones that don't see themselves as investors. Normal people, minorities, women, people that normally see themselves as people that don't feel the natural profile of an investor because they are discriminated, because they are not seen as basically a white man, rich man. And many people, even if they are not a super investor, a high net worth individual, maybe this person has a pension scheme, for example. So they are investing, but they don't see themselves as investors. So think about the power of all of these people that are normal people that have some kind of money, and if they are able to invest in social businesses that are really impactful business. So I think my biggest dream is to support as many as possible businesses and do this in a way that don't harm those business. So offering an adequate type of capital for them.
Just a quick follow-up. Do you see it as evolving into like kind of a two-sided marketplace, like connecting businesses, social businesses with investors and you know, I guess, unlikely or underestimated investors?
Yes, totally. Part of our idea is try to do this matchmaking process, trying to find the impact investors. So the ones that are the investors that are the ones that are more aligned with the idea of impact, that really want to do something good for society, for the environment, and trying to connect them with the most impactful businesses.
Yeah, love that idea. And you're preaching to the choir here. Like, had both my parents were small business owners. I ended up, you know, obviously starting an agency, starting a, you know, still relatively small business. And I just see so much value in, you know, the grassroots kind of approach to, let's just like, you know, help millions of small businesses and kind of scale up from there, give them the capital they need. I love the idea of driving new capital, you know, towards small businesses from folks who haven't thought of themselves as investors. So I'm in love with that idea, and I wish you the best success with it.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's something that's come up on a few other pods, actually, is how broken the VC model is in terms of, you know, venture capital funds have way more money than they invest every year, and they only invest in companies that they think are going to be the next Uber or the next, you know, massive unicorn. But that means that's all you're ever looking for, you only invest, you know, the 1% of successful pitches that end up in VC world. And I just think eventually there will be a shift where even those big VCs that are, you know, the walled gardens and traditional kind of ivory towers go, well, look, rather than making 20 times our investment, why don't we invest in a company that's only going to be sold, you know, become worth £10 million and double our investment, and then we can have, rather than having, you know, £4 billion sitting in the bank doing nothing, we can, you know, send it out into the world and do much better, regardless of the fact that ethically it's the right thing to do. I do just think eventually VCs will realize there's a monetary value there as well, and that they can make a lot more out of their investment if they do much smaller businesses rather than always looking for the next unicorn. So at least that's my hope, and hopefully, you know, driven by people like yourself, Anna, reality can become truer quicker. But just talking to the kind of work you've been doing already, it'd be great to know, like, what have kind of been some of the big success stories so far of altruistic capital, and, you know, if you can share those with us.
Yes, your points are super interesting. So I think that's part of our success, that is trying to bring. The adequate type of capital for social businesses, and not VC is not the solution all the time. And when it is the solution, it's not the way that is being done so far. So we need to rethink the way that investment structures are built and try to remodel them. And another problem, and this is related to our success story, is about the time that social entrepreneurs need in order to find an investor and to close a deal. So usually the time that they need is around 1 year to find an investor and 4 to 6 months to close the deal after finding an investor. And after this process, they might go into a deal that's not good for them. So our goal is reduce this time and offer the adequate type of capital for them. So we have success stories around social entrepreneurs that run businesses that are not the unicorn type, like, for example, businesses that offer services for homeless people, or that is around training people. And this is the kind of business that not all the time is connected to a tech solution. And that's why I love this podcast, because tech cannot save us all the time. And that's a good example. For this kind of business, they need a different type of capital. So we have been supporting businesses that are not the ones that are in the mainstream, are not the ones that are the most wanted by a traditional investor, and making those business access capital in a much less time and with an adequate structure. good in terms of the deal.
Yeah, you've spoken a couple times about your experience in the government. I think it was specifically like the Ministry of Social Affairs. So it sounds like you were tackling issues like unemployment, poverty, violence. Could you say a little bit more about that and how that's informed your work, you know, launching Altruistic Capital as well?
Yes, working for the government is super great because imagine that no other organization has the same budget, the same power, the same resources in general. So working for the government is exciting because you feel that you are impacting many lives. But at the same time, it's hard, it's challenging because all the processes are very slow. Every program to be implemented requires a lot of political consensus, needs budget, and this is not easy all the time. And I worked for the central government. Working for the central government is also challenging because you work in a program that you are not going to implement. So you are not going to see the results because you're not working in the ground base. So I liked a lot having contact with the communities. I liked a lot seeing the effectiveness of the programs, as I told you. So during this transition or complementing my experience in the government as an entrepreneur is a way to have this contact with the problems in a more direct way, I should say, and being able to do my own activities in my pace without the need of building lots of consensus with lots of people and actually seeing the results immediately, or even if it's not immediately, faster than in the government, for example, that we would see the results in years, in 5 years, in 7 years, for example.
Yeah, it's interesting what you say about like the scale of government. It kind of speaks to the point that I was trying to make earlier about how much we've been sort of driven away from government, you know, having solutions for people. And it's actually encouraging for you to hear you say, like, you know, you've never worked in a place where you have that scale and that that power essentially to make, and that you felt heartened by like what you saw in terms of like the results you can achieve with government. Because I think to Will's earlier point, like we've been so soaked in the Thatcherite, Reaganite sort of ideology of like, you know, what did Reagan say? He's like the worst 9 words in the English language are I'm here from the government, or I'm from the government and I'm here to help. Like how terrible is that? Like that was pushed out to generations of kids that like, you shouldn't even think about these people who are literally hired on your family's tax dollars to help you. You shouldn't think about them as helpers. You should think about them as the enemy almost, you know, and we're seeing that lots of different ways. So it's really encouraging to hear you talk about your experience working in government and, you know, again, the scale and the impact that you can have and the results that you can have. So I think Will's going to follow up with a question about your journey as well, which is connected to that.
Yeah. Tell us about your journey. You know, you've had a really cool path to end up where you are today, from, you know, professor, teaching social policy to founding, you know, what you have. Talk to us about that journey of your career.
Yes, I think it's a kind of a complementary path, because at the government, I had the chance to design social programs, to learn a lot about social issues, to understand the importance of the government. I still recognize that without the government, it's not possible to have people feeling that they are citizens, because even with all the rise of this mindset of social businesses, and even if all social businesses are able to be very effective, the government still has the biggest power, the biggest resources, and we need strong public policies. But working at the government requires a big level of resilience, since you are not able, as I was telling you, we are not able to see the results immediately of your work, and because you need many consensus in order to implement a program. So being an entrepreneur and trying to work in this very same area, that is the social and the environment sector, but working with businesses, it's a complement, because I can use all the knowledge that I have in terms of understanding the social problems, the cause roots of problems, but adding the layer of investment, adding the layer of inclusiveness, but from the side of giving people opportunity, jobs, investment. Because my mindset is that if I support social businesses that are doing a great job in terms of inclusiveness, social justice, giving job opportunities, I'm kind of doing the same job of that the government does, but from other perspective. And they are complementary. Because the most important thing that I learned so far in my life, in my personal life and on my professional life, is that we can't save anybody. So any program can save anybody, can take anybody from any kind of bad situation. The person needs to be taken from the situation, to get off the situation. And what people need is opportunities. And the government needs to do this, and social businesses also need to do this. So the mindset for me is the same. So I think the government more and more needs to work with their beneficiaries, thinking that they are customers. And the same thing for social business. They need to think that who they are going to benefit in the end are customers, even if they are people in need or in vulnerability. So for me, it's very complementary to work in one field and another, but from a different perspective.
Your journey, I think, is really interesting because I think I've seen a lot of people in, I'll loosely say our generation, I have no idea how old you are, but, you know, move from like working for government to working for nonprofits and charities to getting into business and things like that. And just the different perspectives they have. I mean, even I've done it. Different perspectives about how they affect change in those different locations has been really fascinating. And the lessons they've learned and how they've taken those lessons with them into different jobs and things like that. So that I think your story is kind of exemplary of that, of like taking learning and applying it in different places, ultimately trying to have an impact wherever you go. Taking us into the lightning round, we just asked like 5 questions that are kind of a little bit cheeky, a little bit fun, that give the audience a bit more information about you. So we'll just roll through those. But the first question, since we are a tech podcast, is what's been a game-changing tech product in your life?
I think it's my key car. Because all the time in the past, when I didn't have an electronic key, I lost my keys and my life was terrible because of this. So now that I have these electronic keys, it's amazing because I just tap. I don't even need to tap the key at the car. I just need to get near the car and the car opens and I know that the keys are with me because they click. So it's amazing.
When I think about key cards, I'm just like, why don't we have, like when I go to a hotel, I'm like, why don't we have key cards for every door ever created? Like at this point, you know, it just seems silly that we have these like jangly pieces of metal in our pocket. Yet I have like a computer in my pocket that is more powerful than, you know, all the computers that ever existed when the keys were made or something. But anyway, well, cool. Well, second question, obviously, you know, the name of the podcast, Tech Can't Save Us related. What's one problem that tech can't solve for us and why?
So I love your podcast, and this question I love also, because all my idea, my business idea is related to this question. That is, how can we support businesses that even if they are not a super tech business? And why is this? Because relationships, we are not able to change relationships with tech. We are just able to change relationships with people, with humans, with relationships. And we need to change our culture in order to face all social and environmental problems that we have. So even the businesses that are based on tech, they need to have, in my opinion, if they have a mindset that is related to face a social or environmental issue, they need to have certain kind of concern about how to change culture, how to involve people from community, how to change relationships among us people. And yes, that's the answer. Tech cannot save us in terms of the kind of relationships that we have, only humans and relationships.
Yeah, it's a great answer. And I think you see it come out to people thinking of tech as like a thing separate from us. But when you look at, you know, obviously what's happening with AI and programming of different like machine learning and robots and things like that, we're seeing our biases and our prejudices filter into those areas. So like it kind of needs to start with us and our intentions and our, you know, our heart, as it were. I think that's a great answer. Related question, tech for bad. We're a tech for good podcast. We like to talk about tech for bad. What's the most evil, the evilest application of tech that you've seen out there?
I think any technology is made to be bad or good. Maybe you agree with me. I don't know. I'm curious to know. But I think AI, for example, is being used in a very bad way. Because we know all the good things that it's possible to do with AI, but nowadays companies are using it to do predictions about our behavior and doing this to incentivize our brains to create more dopamine. And we can see this with all the problems with social media and with children using social media. So it's not that, for example, social media is bad or AI is bad. It's just the use of it.
Yeah, really well said. You're talking to someone who just took Instagram off of his phone for the first time in a while. And just like, you know, I started to really come to grips with, how much of my own behavior am I really controlling here? Just kind of going back to the slot machine and, you know, it's innocent stuff, memes, friends, pictures, my own, you know, but I wanted to take more control. And you really worry with the algorithms, like how much they're really starting to exert control over even our own behavior and like, you know, questioning, makes me question what free will is at this point when we're so bombarded with, you know, all these influences. So really well said. On the flip side of that, if you could create a new tech product, what problem would it solve and for whom?
I dream with materials that are life. I don't know how I'm going to explain this. But do you know mimicry? Biomimicry?
Oh, biomimicry. Sorry. Yes.
So I dream about a age that we will have biomimicry, but with life stuff. So imagine, for example, do you know coconut?
Yes.
Okay. So the water in the coconut, it doesn't get bad. It doesn't go bad. What happens is that the water turns into the coconut that we eat. And this is very interesting because if you take the water off the coconut, the water is going to go bad. But if you maintain into the coconut itself, it's not going to go bad. If you think about all problems related to package, for example, if we could create things that are live as the coconut, because I think I'm not a chemistry or any kind of things. I don't understand really, but I feel that there are some kind of chemical substance in the coconut that is able to make the water stays good for months. So I hope somebody develops this technology that things are going to be live and biomimicry is going to evolve to this mindset of making things not only similar to the nature in terms of the design, but also in terms of the chemistry.
No, that's a fantastic answer. And it makes me wonder why all water isn't stored in coconuts. For one, it probably would taste more delicious. But also for two, I didn't know that about coconuts. That's amazing. It reminded me of, I just watched a show on Netflix. I think it's called The Future Of. And then it follows, you know, the future of cars, the future of buildings, the future of, and there was an episode about plants. And they talked about biomimicry and how eventually we'll get to a point where we can basically program plants to like provide shade or to open up, you know, like imagine palm trees palm trees on the street that open up when it rains to protect people from the rain or something like that. Like it absolutely blew my mind what they're realizing they can do with CRISPR and, you know, basically, you know, genetically engineering plants. Obviously there's a danger to it, but the things that we're going to be able to do, basically, you know, all the things that we use like building materials for, we could all basically get plants to do that. So buildings made of plants, shade structures made of plants, you know, piping maybe even made of plants, so on and so forth. So your answer is fantastic. You should watch that episode on Netflix. Cool. Last two questions of the round. So yeah, we'd love to ask our guests for predictions. So yeah, what is like one big prediction you have for the tech for good or just the tech space in general for the next year?
I think communication is going to evolve a lot. I think we already seen this with the pandemic because we needed to communicate, and we are seeing right now what Facebook is doing in terms of enabling communication in 3D, for example, using holograms and this kind of stuff. So I think we are going to have an evolution in terms of how we communicate in a more realistic way. So I think in a few years we're going to smell people even if we are not with them. A strange thing to think about, but I think we are going to get at this point.
Yeah, I think that's a great way. Yeah, it's interesting because I think, you know, before phones were invented, I'm sure people were like, how can I hear someone if they're not next to me? You know, but you made the point, like, how could I smell someone if they're not next to me? It's just a matter of time until we connect the senses over distance. So, and I think about that too with video. Like, I'm just like, we have to figure out a better way than just staring at screens. Like, and you're starting to see it happen with like holographic, you know, sort of metaverse, being in a room with the people that you're talking to. So last question, I think it speaks to the heart of what you're trying to do, but when we talk about tech for good, we always talk about people trying to balance profit and purpose, you know, in their lives. So what's worked well for you in terms of balancing profit, you know, making money, supporting your family, and also fulfilling, you know, the purpose that you want to fulfill?
It's amazing to do something that you believe in, that you are passionate about, that you are all the time willing to do it. So I really liked my job at the government, but right now I'm super passionate. I don't want to stop working. And the fulfilling is great. I feel very happy. So I think many people is trying to change their careers right now because everybody wants to be happy in their profession. And I think I didn't achieve what I want with Altruistic Capital because I'm just starting. But I have this fulfillment sensation, this sensation that I'm doing the right thing and for the right purpose. So it's amazing.
Yeah, thank you for that. It really, I feel what you're saying because it changes even the way you get up in the morning. Like I knew I did the right thing by starting the agency and focusing on tech for good and charities in terms of our clientele, because I get up every day and I'm genuinely excited to go to work, which in the past, obviously, you know, have felt that less or not at all. But I sort of have this mindset of, oh, I get to do this thing. I get to, you know, be creative for this client that I love, or I get to, you know, sort out this marketing problem that this other client that I love is having. So it just changes your mindset from I have to I get to, you know, when you're really living your purpose. So, well, it sounds like you're living your purpose. We're so grateful to have you on Tech Can't Save Us. Anna Moreno, founder of Altruistic Capital. Yeah, thank you so much for your time today. It was lovely to speak with you.
Thank you, too, Paul. This moment was really great. I love to know you, and I love to know William also. So thank you very much for this opportunity.
You bet. And real quick, can you let our guests know where they can find you, where they can find Altruistic Capital on the interwebs?
Okay, so just find me on LinkedIn. It's Altruistic Capital. And on Instagram is altruistic.capital. So, and our website is all the same, altruistic.capital. So it's very easy.
Got it. And we'll include those links in the episode description, so it's easy for folks to click on and find you. And we wish you the best of luck with Altruistic Capital. And it's a very exciting project. We're very happy to see you come in the door. And best of luck with everything. And thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.